Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezrich. The U.S. military has said it has carried out airstrikes against the Islamic State on Sunday and Monday near Mount Sinjar in southwest of Baghdad. They represent the first air attack since President Obama outlined his plan last week. Meanwhile, this week, Congress will take up a measure that would fund President Obama's plan to train and arm rebels in Syria. Tomorrow, the House of Representatives is to vote on the measure, and the Senate will likely do the same shortly after. The $500 million measure is expected to be attached to a continuing resolution, a spending bill that will fund the federal government through December. As of now, the measure is expected to pass easily. And yesterday, Attorney General Eric Holder announced a series of programs to try to discourage Americans from going to Iraq and Syria to fight with the Islamic State. This is Attorney General Eric Holder.
Today, few threats are more urgent than the threat posed by violent extremism. And with the emergence of groups like ISIL and the knowledge that some Americans are attempting to travel to countries like Syria and Iraq to take part in ongoing conflicts, the Justice Department is responding appropriately. I am announcing that the Department of Justice is partnering with the White House, the Department of Homeland Security, and the National Counterterrorism Center to launch a new series of pilot programs in cities across the nation. These programs will bring together community representatives, public safety officials, religious leaders, and United States attorneys to improve local engagement, to counter violent extremism, and ultimately to build a broad network of community partnerships to keep our nation safe.
And again, that was Attorney General Eric Holder in a video statement released yesterday. Well, for more on all of this, we are joined by Arun Kundnani. He's the author of the book, The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror. He also teaches at John Jay College and New York University. He joins us on Skype from New York City. Arun Kundnani, it's my great pleasure to welcome you to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's begin. First, your reaction to this program that Attorney General Eric Holder announced yesterday. I guess it's a series of programs.
Right. Well, this program has actually been going on since around 2010, where the White House has been running a kind of series of initiatives in Muslim American communities, kind of billed as trying to prevent radicalization. This is something that's actually been imported from Britain, where similar programs were set up from 2006. There's a few things to say about this. Firstly, the main way in which the US government tries to intervene to prevent terrorism amongst the American population is by putting very large numbers of informants into American Muslim communities, on the assumption that Muslim communities are the primary place from which the threat of terrorism might come, which isn't actually true if you look at the data, for example, on right-wing groups who are also involved in acts of violence within the United States. But more importantly, what that's done is kind of create this atmosphere of suspicion and mass surveillance in American Muslim communities, because we have so many informants in mosques and in community organizations and places where Muslims are likely to be. What the US government is proposing to do alongside all of that mass surveillance is also then to have a kind of community engagement element, which is a step in the right direction. But a lot depends on how you do that. The model that's been imported from Britain ends up being problematic for a couple of reasons. The first thing is, at the heart of it, it has this concept of radicalization, which is a word that we now see floating around all over the place when it comes to discussing these issues. We never used this word more than a decade ago when we were talking about terrorism. It's a new concept.
Well, that's what I was going to say. We're all very familiar with counterterrorism, but we hardly hear the term, and I think you've heard it much more than maybe the general public, of counter-radicalization.
The term terrorism itself, it can be quite slippery, but at least we seem to sort of have a sense that it involves some act of violence or contributing towards some act of violence. With radicalization, it's more about ideas. It's the sense that someone has bad ideas. They're saying things that are extreme according to the government, and therefore we need to have some kind of government intervention into their life. And so it kind of crosses that line from action to speech, the line that the First Amendment to the Constitution is intended to ensure is not crossed. You know, young people tend to often look at the world, see, you know, a large number of injustices take place. You know, they feel that emotionally and want to kind of try and make sense of why the world is like that. And people turn to all kinds of different places ideologically to try and make sense of that. You know, we kind of understood that, I think, 20 years ago, right? And so we had an understanding that being a young radical was not seen as a national security issue. It was seen as maybe quite a good thing that young people would explore radical ideas. And if anything, what they needed was kind of help and guidance from the educational system or from mentors to kind of do that in a way that was, you know, hopefully as they go on getting more intellectually mature and giving them opportunities to engage in the political process so that they can express their frustrations through various things like being involved in youth movements, political movements, social activism and so forth. Whereas now, especially when it comes to young Muslims, we see that kind of sense of kind of radicalism as incredibly dangerous, and we criminalize it. But the reality is it ends up being counterproductive, and that becomes very clear when you look at, for example, the Boston Marathon bombing case, right? When what you saw there was again, Tamil Ensanayev, one of the accused perpetrators, clearly struggling with these kinds of issues of like, why is the world the way it is, right? All kinds of anger about foreign policy issues, about global politics. And he goes to the mosque a short while before the bombing, and he expresses some of those views in the mosque and he expresses those frustrations. But as a result, the mosque ejects him. And this is what every mosque now will do when any young person expresses strong political opinions.
Because they see that person as a danger. Legally speaking.
Exactly. There's no longer a, you know, mosques are under incredible scrutiny from federal agencies. And so they want to, in order to protect themselves and not attract attention from federal agencies, anyone expressing strong political opinions is dispatched and excluded.
And we're just talking strong political positions. We're not talking about some type of an attack.
Right. He was not talking about any kind of attack at that point. He was not expressing even, you know, kind of any kind of intellectual support for violence. He was just expressing strongly worded criticisms of the U.S. government. You end up in a situation where you're disabling those resources in the community that could actually intervene in these young people's lives. Have those kinds of conversations with them about, you know, let's try and give you the emotional support that you might need. Let's try and actually talk about why you feel that way about politics and what kinds of things you might get involved in that could channel that in positive ways rather than, you know, the negative ways in which it ended up with the tragedy of the marathon bombing, right? So we lose the opportunity to do these kinds of interventions by creating this kind of culture of self-censorship in the community, a culture of kind of fear and silence in the community. I've just been reporting on a story that will be coming out for The Nation magazine shortly, which is about a case of an American Muslim from Springfield, Massachusetts, who discovered that his wife was an FBI informant. It gets very, very intimate in terms of the extent of the government's attempts to gather information about
that his wife was an FBI informant. FBI came to her after they were married.
It seems that she was recruited before the marriage and was then and then set out to meet this guy and get married to him.
So it wasn't even, well, I don't know whether or not if it's real love, but that the intent, the FBI intended her to marry somebody they wanted to.
He was a target. Of the FBI as a Muslim community activist already, and this woman had worked for the FBI before, and somehow between them they came up with this plan that she would have an arranged marriage with this guy, and so then they ended up they didn't register the marriage officially, but they had a religious wedding ceremony, then they lived together. And a year later, he discovered that she was an informant for the FBI the whole time.
Arun Kanani, I don't mean to have you scoop yourself on my show before your report comes out, but this is shocking.
Yeah, and I mean, it is shocking. I was trying to find out if there were other examples of this kind of thing happening in you know, previous decades. The closest thing I could find was in the 1980s, the FBI was investigating an organization, I think I remember rightly, called the Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, which was an organization that many of the people who ran it were nuns, and they were supporting victims of American foreign policy in El Salvador in the 1980s. And the FBI ran an informant who infiltrated the organization and set out with FBI approval to seduce one of the nuns and therefore have blackmail material over her to then recruit her as an informant as well. So that's an example of, again, the way in which romantic relationships, marriage, sexual relationships can get abused in these ways.
Again, we are in conversation with Arun Kundnani. He is the author of the book, The Muslims Are Coming. He also teaches at New York University and John Jay College. Arun, I want to talk a little more about the notion of counter-radicalization here in this country. And also, you survey it here as well as in the UK. Reports indicate that there are about 100 U.S. citizens who have gone to Syria to fight against the government of President Bashar al-Assad. We hear about people from the West, including Europe, perhaps especially Europe, going to fight either with the Islamic State or similar type groups. What's your take on that?
It's certainly the case that a number of people have gone over from the U.S., from Europe. Their motivations, I think, are varied. The largest proportion, I think, have gone over to participate in various humanitarian activities over there, supporting people in refugee camps and so forth. I mean, I don't think we have a very clear sense of the level of kind of human suffering in Syria that has come about over the last few years because of the violence of the Assad regime, the huge numbers of people who've died. And that is something that resonates with Muslim communities in Europe and the United States. And so there's been a desire to go over there for humanitarian reasons. Then there's a certain number of people who've gone over to participate in one of the opposition groups. You know, the situation of the opposition groups is complex, right? As we can recognize if we realize that, you know, some of the opposition groups like the Free Syrian Army are being supported by the CIA and the US government. But then other opposition groups fighting effectively on the same side against the Assad regime are considered the greatest security threat to the United States, right? Like ISIS and Nusra. The situation is complex. So some people have gone over to fight with, for example, the Free Syrian Army. In the early days, that was kind of green-lighted by the US government because they were on our side and the CIA was supporting them. So there was no real objection to an American going over and joining that group. There are some who've also joined ISIS, right? The question then is there a danger that some of those people who've joined ISIS, and we're talking about the numbers that have come out from the US government and from European governments are a little bit vague in the sense that you don't know which exact groups that they have gone to, because they talk in terms of foreign fighters, and that would presumably include people who've gone as foreign fighters to join groups that we support. So we don't know exactly the numbers that have joined ISIS, but let's assume it's a dozen or so people from the United States. Then the question is, will one of those people come back to the United States and want to carry out acts of violence here? And of course, that's possible. But I think we're kind of exaggerating the threat.
Arun Kanani, I'm also interested in what your take is, and how do you think they're responding in the UK? One of the videos, or three of the videos that we've seen, right, of the three beheadings is what's believed to be a British man, he's allegedly a hip-hop artist, Abdel Majed Abdel Barry.
Yeah. Well, if he is indeed the person who's perpetrating these kind of terribly spectacularly kind of gruesome beheadings, then he's the son of a man who's actually currently being held in custody in New York. Someone who's been through a very long process of extradition from the UK, has been imprisoned for a very long time, with very little evidence against him. He's actually wanted by the Egyptian government more than anyone else. If the perpetrator of these beheadings does turn out to be this man's son, then at least part of the story here is the experience of this kid growing up, seeing his father, you know, what he must perceive his father to have been a victim of a miscarriage of justice that's denied him his father for a very long time as he was growing up.
I did not know that about his father.
Right. And again, you know, we have to just be clear that we don't know for sure that the
correct
the person that everyone's speculating, you know, this guy who did these rap videos, that is him. But if it is him, then that would be part of the story. You know, I think.
But it hasn't been part of the story.
But that has not really been part of the story in the way it's been reported. A British journalist called Victoria Britton has done some very good reporting a few years ago on this family's experience, and that writing now looks potentially very relevant in terms of trying to understand what might have led to this young man from London being involved in something so gruesome and macabre. I think this is a story that's as much about the experience of Muslim communities in Britain as it is a story about, you know, the particular context of Syria and Iraq. And it's a complex story. I mean, I don't think we can sum it up in an easy soundbite. But one of the things I try and do in the book is look at the experience of young Muslims in Britain, try and understand what it's like to grow up in this environment of, you know, long-standing issues of institutional racism in the police and so forth. Then with the war on terror, this kind of way in which Muslims globally become targeted, all kinds of experience of civil rights abuses within the UK through the kind of counter-terrorist policies that we had. And I think when you start to piece all these elements together, you can understand maybe why a very small number of people, particularly if on top of that experience they have certain emotional or psychological problems, why you might end up with the situation that we've seen over the last week or so.
I think liberals should stop booing me for pointing out that Islam is not like other religions, that is a unique threat.
Behind every Muslim is a future member of some radical...
Let me finish.
I thought I was doing that.
There are illiberal beliefs that are held by vast numbers of Muslim people that I don't think...
Vast number of Christians, too.
No, that's not true. Not true. Vast numbers of Christians do not believe that if you leave the Christian religion, you should be killed for it. Vast numbers of Christians do not treat women as second-class citizens. Vast numbers of Christians...
No, I agree with that.
...do not believe that if you draw a picture of Jesus Christ, you should get killed for it. So, yes, does ISIS do Khmer Rouge-like activities where they just kill people indiscriminately who aren't just like them? Yes. And would most Muslim people in the world do that or condone that? No. But most Muslim people in the world do condone violence. Just for what you think. They do. First of all, they say it. They shout it from the...
Vast majorities of Muslims.
Absolutely. There's a Pew poll of Egypt done a few years ago. 82%, I think it was, said stoning is the appropriate punishment for adultery. Over 80% thought death was the appropriate punishment for leaving the Muslim religion.
And again, that was Bill Maher on the Charlie Rose Show. We are speaking to Arun Khandnami. He is the author of the book, The Muslims Are Coming. Your take on the public discourse occurring right now and examples that we just heard.
Right. Well, you know, I'm an atheist, and I'm not kind of interested in just some kind of happy-clappy kind of multiculturalism that says all religions are basically the same. But Bill Maher's mistake here... is to think that what causes terrorism or what causes violence or what causes, the oppression of women is simply this thing called Islam, right? Or simply the passages in the Quran, right? If you think that the Quran causes terrorism, then you have a problem in explaining why it's only in the 20th century that some Muslims start to interpret the concept of jihad in a way that supports terrorism, right? So for 1,000 years before the 20th century, jihad wasn't interpreted that way, right? So what changes in the 20th century should be the key question here if we're trying to understand what causes terrorism. And then you can't really explain that by the religious dimension. It's not that you have out of the blue some kind of new religious interpretation that leads to this. What it is a changed political context, right? It's the context of the Middle East in the 20th century finding itself in a context where it's territory has been conquered and occupied by by Europe, right? And so in that situation, just like any other people anywhere in the world, when they're going through a time of injustice or struggle, may well turn to their religion to try and make sense of it, even reinterpret their religion to give them ways of dealing with that. That's exactly what happened in the Middle East in the 20th century. It's the colonial context that explains these new ideas within Islam in the 20th century that people often cite as the kind of forefathers of Al-Qaeda, people like Sayyid Qutb in Egypt, right? It's colonialism that really explains that. And same with, you know, same with Palestine, right? The from the formation of Israel to the late 60s or so, or early 70s, Palestinians are not involved in terrorism, right? They're petitioning the United Nations, they're petitioning Arab leaders to try and resolve the fact that they've been, you know, turned into refugees and driven out of their homes and so forth. And no one listens and no one does anything about it. And so then for some number of them, terrorism becomes the way to attract attention to their experience and their issue. It's not that suddenly, and even at that point, the terrorism is not being done in the name of religion. It's being done in the name of a Palestinian national movement. It's only with the defeat of the kind of secular nationalist Palestinian movement later on in the 1990s that you get a religious movement, right, which is Hamas, which is then for the first time starting to use religion as an argument.
Well, why do you think it went to religion, a religious argument?
Well, because I think, you know, you had a situation where, you know, the kind of secular nationalist way of thinking about the Palestinian struggle that had been predominant up until then had kind of been defeated, right? It was not delivering a solution for the Palestinian people. It had been sucked into the Oslo process, which most Palestinians viewed as not a resolution to the problem, because it didn't actually create a Palestinian state that had any kind of territorial integrity. In that vacuum, then what is the other kind of ideological framework that you might turn to if you think that the secular nationalist framework has failed? Well, it's the religious framework, right? And so the language and the vocabulary changes, but essentially it's still a political movement.
Can we compare this type of political violence to, say, the political violence we saw in this country 100 years ago with anarchists?
I mean, I think anarchists are an interesting case to compare to some of the acts of violence over the last few years that we tend to think of as terrorism, coming from sort of Al-Qaeda or people linked to Al-Qaeda. The anarchist bombers had this idea when they were carrying out acts of violence, you know, 150 years ago or 100 years ago, they had this idea that that the world is there's a kind of illusion that all of us have been brainwashed into, right, about the world being okay, and that if only everyone could see through that illusion, right, to understand how the world looks from the point of view of the anarchists, that everyone would rise up, right, and it would kind of, the illusion would shatter, right? And so the violence for a lot of these anarchists was about some kind of shocking event that would kind of trigger this kind of wider popular uprising, because in the aftermath of that event of violence, the illusion would fall away, right? The illusion of power that we've all been brainwashed into would fall away. It's that kind of thinking. That's exactly the same kind of thinking that if you read the writings of Ayman al-Zawahiri, right, with the Egyptian who's currently the leader of Al-Qaeda, who had a earlier kind of history before Al-Qaeda involved in Islamic Jihad in Egypt. When he was involved in carrying out the assassination of Sadat, the Egyptian leader, he had exactly the same idea that we carry out the assassination of this leader of Egypt. And that night, when news spreads that Sadat is gone, the people will rise up, right? People don't rise up because that's not how politics works, but the thinking is very similar to this anarchist thinking. And of course with the anarchists, in order to understand how they end up getting to this point of thinking that violence is the answer, you have to look at the political context. So a lot of those anarchist bombers are veterans of the Paris Commune in 1871, where you have this kind of uprising in Paris by working class people who try and take over the city and run it themselves. And then the French send in the army and, you know, tens of thousands of ordinary people are killed. And it's the brutality of that massacre that then leads a number of people with a kind of anarchist politics to say, OK, now's the time for us to use violence too, right? And now it becomes legitimate for us to start using violence. So, again, it illustrates the way in which there's this kind of, you know, there's this kind of feedback loop, right? There's this kind of blowback effect with when states carry out mass violence against civilians, there's always going to be the possibility that some of those civilians will then become people who believe in using violence back against that state.
Arun Khandani has been our guest. Arun Khandani is an adjunct professor of media, culture, and communications at New York University. He also teaches terrorism studies at John Jay College. He is the author of such books as The End of Tolerance, Racism in the 21st Century Britain. And his newest book out this year is called The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror. Arun Khandani, I thank you greatly for taking time and joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.